From 11FS, this is FinTech Insider News, and I'm your host, Ross Gallagher, Ventures Director at 11FS. Thanks for downloading this podcast. If you like what you hear, please recommend to a friend. This week, we're talking Griffin get their full UK banking license after a new $24 million funding round pushes them over the capital requirements limits. The training wheels are off and they're open for business. CFIT claim open finance could unlock $30.5 billion for the UK's GDP, that while solving for some of our biggest economic problems. And we all know transport and travel agents charge more during busy times, but what about your local restaurant? It might be happening. It might not. We get into all this and much more on today's show. Welcome to episode 835 of FinTech Insider. I'm Ross Gallagher, Ventures Director here at 11FS, and I'm joined this week on FinTech Insider News by three guests who are here to break down the biggest stories from the past week in fintech and financial services. Now, firstly, I'm delighted to welcome back to the podcast Ezechi Britton, CEO at CFIT. Ez, it really is a pleasure to be back behind the mic together. Maybe you can just remind our listeners a little about yourself and what you do.
Hey, everyone. So Ezechi Britton, or Ez, as most people know me, I'm the CEO of CFIT, UK Centre for Finance, Innovation and Technology. We're an independent change agent with the backing of Treasury and City of London, who exists to bring together academia, industry, regulators and policymakers to drive forwards innovation in financial services through our coalitions model. It's great to be back on and to have a bit of a chance to talk about what we've been up to recently.
Excellent. All right. Thanks, Ez. We are also delighted to be joined by David Jarvis, CEO at Griffin. David, welcome back as well. I know it's been a big week for you guys over at Griffin, and we'll get into that in a little bit, but maybe you can just tell our listeners again a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Hi, I'm David. It's a pleasure to be back. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Griffin. We are a bank that banks fintechs, so we largely bank payments and wealth companies. You can think of us as a banking as a service platform that actually has a bank license.
Nice. I like a bank that banks. I kind of stopped at that point.
You.
Yeah, that was really good.
Normally, I come off with something a little bit cleaner that's just like, we bank fintechs.
Yeah, I like a bank that banks. I think that's great. And finally, a big FinTech Insider hello to Raquel Suarez, Head of Marketing for Edenred Payment Solutions. So Raquel, thank you so much for joining us. Again, maybe you can just tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Yes. So hi, everyone. My name is Raquel Suarez, and I'm the Head of Marketing at Edenred Payment Solutions, formerly known as PPS, and we are a payment solutions provider. We help businesses launch digital banking and embedded finance products. We are an EMI regulated by the FCA here in the UK and also by the National Bank of Belgium in Europe. And thanks so much for having me. I'm a huge fan of the podcast, so I'm very excited to be here today.
Awesome, Raquel. Thank you. The pleasure's all ours. All right, so that's our panel. And before we dive into the show, just a reminder to all you FinTech Insider fans, because After Dark is coming back to London. Join us at Village Underground on Thursday, 21st of March, to watch my co-host David Breer alongside Jamie Campbell, Georgie Frost, and Alex Rivas-Gale record a live episode of FinTech Insider News. You can find all of the details and secure your spot right now at 11fs.com/afterdark. And alternatively, if you can't get to London on that date, or if you're listening to this in the future, you can also sign up to our mailing list to be one of the very first to hear about our other events. Now, to do that, just visit 11fs.com/community for more information. All right, with that, let's jump into the news. Now, our first story this week comes from FinExtra with a headline, Griffin raises $24 million and launches as a fully operational UK bank. So Griffin, as David so eloquently said, offers fintechs and brands the infrastructure and solutions to embed products into their own apps via an API. However, the latest funding round from banking as a service provider Griffin means they now meet regulatory capital requirements to operate as a fully licensed bank, 1 year after becoming authorized with restrictions. Griffin will now be able to offer interest-bearing bank accounts, access to the UK's payment rails, an integrated ledger, and automated compliance technology. But I guess really there's no point in me telling you all about this when we've got David right here. So David, maybe you can just tell us a little bit more how this came about, and I suppose what has changed exactly, and what does it mean for you guys?
Yeah, thanks, Ross. As Ross and passionate FinTech Insider fans will know, this has been a very long journey for us. So we've been kind of cracking away at this for about 7 years. And last year, we were fortunate enough to receive our initial authorization. And when one becomes authorized as a bank in the UK, it is normal that you enter authorization with restrictions and very specifically a cap on how many deposits you can hold of about £50,000. Now, given that, as I said earlier, we bank fintechs and we tend to bank growth stage fintechs, £50,000 does not go very far. And so the last year for us has really been kind of a training wheels, beta testing period. So we've, you know, we've been in the nursery, making sure that everything works as it needs to. And with this capital raise and us becoming fully operational, there are now no longer any deposit or payment restrictions on our license, which means we are in a position where we are really fully open for business. So that's incredibly exciting. We went live with our first client earlier this week, which is like just a, I mean, huge personal moment after kind of 7 years. And we are, yeah, very much here to bank the UK's fintech scene, whether that is FCA regulated firms that have an EMI license, that have a payments license, that are in the wealth space doing something with client money, or firms that may be offering financial services to their customers, but may not be regulated themselves, right? And so they could be working with another regulated partner to distribute a variety of financial services, and they might want to offer, let's say, interest-bearing savings accounts alongside that other portfolio of services. And we can help them to do that in a really safe and compliant way.
Wow. I mean, yeah, this is no small feat. I mean, breaking into what is a highly regulated space, like you said, those training wheels coming off, it's always a really exciting moment. David, can you tell us a little bit more about, though, that training wheels period and sort of what that looks like, what that feels like? What does it look like from like engagement with the regulator from that perspective? And then I also feel like 1 year to get rid of those restrictions feels quite fast. So maybe reflecting on that a little bit as well.
So when you initially become authorized, you get a letter from the Bank of England, and it says largely congratulations, but also you're not really ready to be fully live. And we in particular think these are the things that you need to improve, demonstrate that you have built out, et cetera. And capital is usually one of those. And so although that kind of £50,000 restriction can sound really onerous, it's actually quite clever in that you're able to become a bank from a legal and regulatory perspective with a really low regulatory capital charge, which means you can then really de-risk this from your potential investor's perspective, right? So otherwise you get into this really big chicken and egg problem where you're like, well, I want 50,000 or sorry, 50 million pounds. And the investor's like, right, but how do I know that you're actually going to get the license? And you're like, because I know I'm going to get the license. And then you just go back and forth. And so the clever thing about this is it allows you to raise, as you know, from our last year's raise, we were able to enter mobilization with about 10 million pounds. And we've spent the year largely doing, I mean, payments integrations, operational resilience work, hiring out a bunch of kind of like key mix of like operations and regulatory needs on an ongoing basis, as well as just like, I would say, generally staffing up our operations function. And then the capital raise, you know, your capital requirement to exit mobilization, if you're a lender is, I mean, so for most banks is driven by your how much lending you want to do. In our case, because we're not an incredibly active lender, at least not for the next year, it's predominantly with regard to our operating capital needs. And so basically the regulators just don't want you to see you like go live and then fail in less than 12 months. So they ask you to make sure that you've got at least 12 months runway plus an extra 6 months of just raw OPEX. So that if you get to the end of those 12 months and you haven't raised more money and you're not seeing the commercial traction that you wanted to, you're able to really safely wind the business down or at least give up the bank license and return everyone's deposits. So, I mean, the nifty thing about authorization with restrictions is that it does also give your customers or your prospects confidence. And in general, the regulators don't let you enter authorization with restrictions unless they really do believe that you're going to be capable of becoming a fully operational bank. And so, generally, there's like a regulatory threshold at which you're able to become authorized. And then there's like a commercial threshold, right? And what I mean by that is we've had quite a few banks in the UK that have entered AWR, as it's called, authorization with restrictions, where they met all the regulatory needs, but, and I'm not saying this in, hopefully in any judgmental way, their business model didn't seem particularly differentiated. And so they then really struggled to raise the capital that they needed to actually go on to fully launch. And so, at least as far as I'm aware, I'm not personally aware of any instances of someone becoming authorized with restrictions and then kind of losing that for any reason other than just kind of running out of money. As I'm sure you will all appreciate, it is not an easy environment in which to raise money at the moment. So we're just incredibly, incredibly happy and excited that we've kind of met that final hurdle on being able to be in a position where we can launch. And so, you know, it's like training wheels off, pencil sharpened. Like at this point, it's just down to us to prove if we can deliver what we said we were going to do or not.
I like it. I mean, it's like training wheels off, but obviously quite an intensive process. But I suppose it's like, okay, you guys are actually now set up for success by the process of sort of having gone through that. And as I saw you getting, you know, quite excited when David was saying that Griffin's open for business. And look, I suppose given your remit at CFID in terms of like making sure that the UK is market leading in that fintech space, this is probably, you'd probably see this as a big win, I guess.
I see this as a huge win, not just as in my role as CFID, but as an ex-fintech entrepreneur who built a regulated lending startup. And I know the challenges we had getting a bank account, right? So having an organization that could facilitate and support in some of those activities with fintechs is absolutely phenomenal. And if we look back at the HSBC SVB situation, we saw the concern and the challenges around regulated startups, the challenge they would have being able to get bank accounts set up without SVB being there, right? And what would that look like? And this was actually one of the potential subjects for a CFID coalition. Actually, was one of the things that we explored before we settled on open finance, which is what can we do to support this particular problem. So it's absolutely brilliant to see David's organization leading the charge in that. And I think if we've got a Griffin there who can actually support UK fintechs get started, then we're going to have a far greater pipeline, which will ultimately lead to better outcomes for UK fintech down the line. So I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, if SVB had not been around, we would not have gotten a basic bank account. Like we went absolutely around the houses and everyone said no. And in the end, the only reason even SVB would bank us was because I happened to have worked for a company that was acquired by the US arm of SVB. And so I had some kind of inroads into the organization. And so, you know, like a lot of what we focus on in terms of our core value proposition is client money accounts, safeguarding accounts, like the stuff that you need to have in order to run an FCA regulated business. But as you know really well, even if like all you're doing is just trying to get a basic operating account so you can raise some venture capital money and actually build out a product, like you know, most of the people are going to say no to you. And so one of the things that we're spending a bunch of time on now is just like, okay, like we need to probably build out our product in a way that supports kind of progressive onboarding, where if someone needs a basic operating account, we don't try and kind of push them through the level of due diligence that we would need if we were safeguarding for them, even if they might want a safeguarding account a year from now. Like they will need that operating account sooner, and we should have a kind of proportionate level of due diligence that enables them to get access to that so that they can build the business before they try and run it.
It is just such an important point, isn't it? When you think about the innovation that we've come to see in the UK and other markets. I mean, it's so foundational, isn't it? That those innovative disruptors are able to get a bank account and actually set up properly, and actually not having that there is sort of like infrastructure, essentially, you lose all of that, don't you? Raquel, what was your sort of reaction to this story? Keen to get your thoughts.
Yeah, so first of all, congrats. That's a huge milestone, especially because it's been somewhat grim in the fintech industry. So it's a great sign, the capital raise, but also getting the license. It's a great signal. Yeah, so my take on it, especially because I'm not inherently from the industry. I worked across multiple different industries, so I'm not super the expert in the topic. But I do find that there has been a lot of discussion around banking licenses, especially in the light of, you know, Revolut, struggling to get one in the past years or so. So there's a lot more awareness around what it means to get a banking license, even if you do have maybe the capital behind it. And so it's a great sign. It just shows that you're well run, you can manage regulation, checks to meet and exceed the FCA regulations. So that's my take. And I think now it all depends on what you're really offering, right? And why what you're using that license for.
And that is an interesting point. And David, I'm going to have to wrap after this, but I suppose as well as sort of the training wheels coming off, being able to scale what it is that you guys already offer, is there anything, is this having a sort of big impact on the future roadmap? Is there anything you want to sort of nod to there?
I mean, I think, you know, we've been on the show a bunch of times and I think two things. So there's what I kind of already talked about, which is the kind of core operating account for fintechs, which was something that we knew was a pain point. And since the failure of SVB has obviously become, has kind of moved up on our product roadmap quite considerably. I think the other thing, and I can't remember when I was last on, I think it probably was when we got authorization with restrictions, but is still this kind of subject of, I guess, how much fintech in the landscape has changed in the last 2 years as we've returned to a non-zero rate environment. And so like the importance of interest-bearing savings accounts just across the entire financial services industry, really. And so, you know, we continue to see huge demand for that and really innovative ways that people are looking to bring finance into a relationship that already makes sense. So I think one of the things that we talk about a lot internally is like, we're not looking to necessarily like intrude, I guess. Some of the kind of universe of embedded finance, right? Like is the Angela Strange, you know, every company is going to be a fintech company. And it's like, well, no, not really. Like you have a lot of financial services relationships. You don't need every, like you have a lot of commercial relationships. You don't need every commercial relationship that you have to try and push you on a prepaid card or, you know, some other form of like financial service, right? But there are a set of financial services or a set of relationships that are more like hub services, right? And so two of the spaces where we think this is really interesting is payroll and rent. We sometimes kind of talk about this internally as like the ultimate subscription economy, right? Because it's like these are the largest payments you're probably making in or like making or receiving out of an account in a month. And so once you have some kind of hook into one of those relationships, there's an ability to kind of leverage that. And so on the rent side, we find ourselves working with like property managers, estate agents, people who are handling like managed residential property flow of funds. And on the rent side, we find ourselves working with salary finance businesses and employee financial wellness companies. So we're not necessarily trying to take over the individual's primary account, but if they already have that sort of financial relationship, there's maybe the opportunity for us to do something else like help that company to offer an interest-bearing savings account, for instance. But yeah, it's always interesting and it's always changing. That's the beautiful thing about fintech and being at the infrastructure layer.
Well, look, I love it. It's incredibly exciting. Thank you for continuing to come on and give us the sort of inside scoop on all of these milestones. This is
thank
obviously
you for
a
having
big
me.
One. No, it's our pleasure. And look, I mean, yeah, reiterate Raquel's point, like huge congratulations. I look forward to the next milestone and the next time you're on.
Oh gosh.
Yeah. All right, so I'm going to move us on. This next story comes from both CFIT and Finextra with a headline, CFIT Open Finance Report. So the Open Finance could boost UK GDP by 30.5 billion. So CFIT assembled a coalition of 60 partners across the banking world to demonstrate the full potential of open finance technology. The proofs of concept developed by the coalition prove that both individual consumers and business customers could benefit from the enhanced data sharing offered by Open Finance, and 30.5 billion could be unlocked and put back into the UK economy. The report also recommends the creation of three different bodies going forward to push the Open Finance agenda and pick up from where open banking has stalled. So we've got Ez Brisson, the CEO of CFIT, here to tell us more. Ez, why don't you kind of give us a little bit of the background into the report and then maybe an insight into where that 30.5 billion pound number came from.
So, I mean, the report, ultimately what we set out to do As I mentioned earlier, we build coalitions of organizations from across the financial services ecosystem to solve these problems. And we look at problems that we believe have strategic advantage and require an entity to sit there to really bring all the stakeholders together, because there's no one organization that can solve this issue. And ultimately, what we're always focused on is how do we create more, how does fintech lead to more jobs, more inclusion, and more trade? And you can see that obviously that 30.5 billion figure taps into the trade piece quite nicely. So when we looked at open finance, we saw a real opportunity to actually hit all three of those markers. And it's clearly a space where government can't seem to move it by itself. The regulators can't move it by itself. And industry can't move it by itself. So what we really wanted to set out to do was to really prove the case for open finance. And actually that 30.5 billion figure stems from a control shift report in 2018 on data mobility and the personal data portability growth opportunity for the UK economy, which in 2017 was measured about 27.8 billion. When you roll forwards and you take a look at inflation, the 2022 figure was at 30.5, and actually today it's probably a lot larger than that. And even that 27.8 billion was an underreporting. So the number is almost certainly far larger than that. But what you're always missing is the provable use case around that. Okay, we can say the number is this, we can say there's value, but how do we actually prove it? So we set up to show that open finance can really impact the lives of consumers and SMEs. And we did that by taking this coalition of over 60 organizations, and that included the likes of the CMA9, big CRAs, big tech, academia, and we were supported by the FCA. We had the UK trade bodies, we had the regional bodies, all around the table. Big fintech, small fintech supporting this activity. And we decided to focus on two key use cases. One was, how do we support SME finance? How do we ensure SMEs can get greater access to credit and help plug that £22 billion funding gap that exists? And number two, how do we deal with financial inclusion? And we looked at, well, how can we support more vulnerable customers? And so by looking at that and taking that coalition, we settled on two particular pilot studies that we'd lead. So we settled on one. When looking at vulnerable customers, we worked with Citizens Advice to see, well, how could we actually support them in serving their client base better? Now, today, they serve about 370,000 people a year, but 70% of phone calls Citizens Advice go unanswered, simply because the volume of calls is too high, the time it takes to go through that process is challenging, and it means there are a lot of people out there who desperately need financial support, financial advice, and can't get it. When we looked at the SME piece, we decided to work with HSBC as a core partner on that activity, and we wanted to look at, well, if we could get access to more information, more data sets, and plug it into your credit decisioning process, what would that do for SMEs who wanted to get access to credit? Could we actually show that doing this would increase the flow of credit to UK SMEs? And bear in mind, there are 5.5 million of them out there. So being able to make that change, have a dent in that, be really, really impactful. So we took those two use cases, we brought our 60 organizations together, and over the last 6 months, we set about actually trying to build solutions to these problems, run research activities, practical applied research around this to see what comes out the other end, and then see if we can really demonstrate that it has that impact. And what is absolutely fantastic about that is that what came out was undeniable fundamentally. We saw from the SME perspective that substantially more lending would be made to small businesses if specific additional data sets were to be made widely available to CRAs and small business lenders. And that our work actually suggested that over 25% of SME loan applicants who've been referred for manual underwriting and would have potentially failed to receive an offer of credit could justifiably be given access to finance. So of those SMEs who would have applied for a loan, not got a yes, not got a no, gone through to a manual underwriting process, maybe, you know, 3 months down the line, and then eventually got a no, actually 25% of them would have got a yes and would have got it immediately. right? So that is a significant upsizing on the amount of credit available to those 5.5 million SMEs that sit out there. When we looked at the vulnerable customers piece, we worked very closely with Citizens Advice on automating their standard financial statements. So when you get through Citizens Advice and you need that support, you need that guidance, one of the first activities you have to do is complete the standard financial statements. And that statement requires something in the realm of 600 data points. Well, by taking information, increasing the access to open banking data, open finance data, what we were able to show was actually Citizens Advice would be able to support an extra 150,000 customers annually. That's a 40% increase. That's over 1 million over the next 10 years. So being able to provide them with tailored financial advice and help some of our most vulnerable citizens out of financial struggles and debt traps. So by looking at the SME piece right there, what we're seeing is the ability to create jobs by having a significant impact on SMEs in the UK, by being able to improve their liquidity, their access to credit, their ability to grow. With the vulnerable customers, what we saw was actually that has a huge impact on inclusion, which was the number two gain that we talked about. And ultimately that 30.5 billion figure shows the impact on trade. So what was clear from this exercise was that open finance genuinely changed lives and has the ability to have a significant impact on UK PLC.
I think that's what comes through really clearly, right? I think when you take that £30.5 billion headline figure in a climate of sort of declining or at best like stagnant economic growth in the UK, right? Tapping into that and unlocking it is incredible. But what really stands out for me is we know that SMEs are still some of the most underserved customers from a financial services perspective, and then the impact that it can have as well on the vulnerable customers. You know, you're talking about real uplift there for two of those most excluded and sort of vulnerable groups. So Raquel, exciting times, right? Open finance, let's do it, right?
Yeah, actually, I do have a question, Ez. So what would be some of these data sources for open finance?
So what we looked at as part of the exercise was very much What could we do if we could get access to VAT records from HMRC, for example, company incorporation data from Companies House, DWP information, along with bank transactional data, open banking data, and CRA data. And actually, we did a prioritization exercise as well. We identified something like 30 data sets overall, including buy now, pay later, local tax and local rental information. You know, there is a whole swathe of data sets that are available out there. Ultimately, though, that HMRC data piece was the number one piece that really had the most impact. And one of the things that we also saw, there was various secondary outcomes from this exercise that we don't really talk to as much. One of them was when we look at those referrals, something like 70% of that group just fall out the funnel. They just don't complete the process. It's too long. It's too painful. It's too difficult. And as you can imagine, for small businesses, it's just a huge time sink. And even getting access to that information. And I've run small businesses. Trying to pay your tax can be a nightmare. You know, do you have the right code so that you can go in and pay it, literally? No, that's not the right 10-digit number. What about that one? Well, I haven't received it yet. You know, and you get bogged down in all the letters. Oh, and it can be painful.
It is.
It can be really painful.
It's just so painful.
So by automating these processes, you can have a significant impact just on the availability. Think about what would happen for some of these businesses. Some of them don't have 3 months to wait for that cash. They've got great businesses, but they're going through a cash crunch and they need access to liquidity immediately. If we could solve for that problem just by getting better access to information, that has a significant uplift and impact on these businesses. The other one, and this was something we did with iWalker, was, and they already, this was why it was such a great coalition. When you got big bank like HSBC and you got a nimble challenger alternative lender like iWalker in the same coalition who already pulls in alternative data sets, but there's still a lot of manual processes there. And what they identified was if they could get access to the VAT records in an automated way, they could increase their lending throughput by 40%. Right? So there were just real tangible outcomes that came from this that demonstrably showed the value and the power of increasing access to both private and public data sets. Now, obviously, this was an exercise. It was prototypes. It was proof of concepts that we were building. We were working with synthetic and artificial data via the FCA sandbox and working with organizations such as Smart Data Foundry, Digital ID, Experian to get access to this type of information. Where we need to see the step change is actually having access to this information. But, and this was one of the key findings in our coalition, it's about putting consent at the heart of all of that. If we think about the open banking flows we have today, we have some very strong, very clear consent and trust frameworks, and that's fantastic. But they work on a one-to-one model. Once we're starting to talk about open finance, open energy, open water, open telco, really we're saying, well, actually, for this particular use case, I need access to this data set, this data set, this data set, this data set. You now need to go and permission all of those, right? So being able to ensure that that experience is one that is comfortable, effective, and secure for the consumer or the business of providing access to information is absolutely critical to this process.
Yeah, we actually asked our community, will open finance have a bigger impact on the industry than open banking? 54% said yes, only 5% said no, 40% said it's too early to tell. And I actually think a lot of that has comes down to the trust point that you made. But David, keen to just get your thoughts, because I know Ez said that this was an exercise, but I expect as someone who banks fintechs and SMEs, a lot of that probably resonated with you in terms of how we can improve those processes and sort of unlock the potential of those businesses.
Yeah, I mean, I am foundationally like a deep regulatory nerd. And so my mind goes to like a whole bunch of personal passion projects that are at the intersection of data and lending and consent and networks and infrastructure, right? So if I can just like throw a couple thoughts out, right? Like, one of the things that is punishing for the relationship between banks and SMEs is that if you don't have a credit rating, it's going to be significantly more capital intensive for a bank to lend against you because it hits their equity requirements harder, right? But that's kind of unfair, right? Like, because we really restrict access to even getting a credit rating. Like, it's expensive, it's time consuming, it's hard. One of the things that's really interesting about opening up data in this way is there's the potential, like one of my fantasy projects is like, and this is also kind of impossible because it's just not lined up with like the type of like companies that I'm able to build in my personal forte would be to build like a credit rating agency that just rates SMEs. And that's all it does. And the banks would pay for it because they want to lend to these businesses, but it hits their equity capital so much that it doesn't make sense for them as in the kind of larger economic sense. And so the really cool thing about the kind of direction of travel for open finance is this could drop the cost of doing those ratings to a point where it actually becomes feasible. So I think that's incredibly cool because that would unlock, like you can either approach it from that lens, which would unlock a ton of capital that banks want to lend to SMEs but can't. The other thing that you could do, right, is you can push for regulatory change, right, where you say, okay, well, what if instead of requiring an SME to be credit rated in order to get that kind of capital hit down, you say, okay, well, actually, if you're able to if you're able to make a loan on the basis of open financial data, then that is kind of reasonably robust data that you should then be able to lower the kind of charge against. And then the last thing that I think is really interesting is this kind of point around one-to-one versus centralization. There's something really interesting there, right? Because this ties also into in equal parts kind of like a consumer duty issue and a data protection issue where, unfortunately, some people do borrow more than they are ever able to repay. And that knowledge can end up being siloed in the different lending institutions. And if you were able to aggregate that in a way that enabled the lenders to have insight into kind of like what someone's current credit exposure was, that also helps them to manage their risk and makes it easier for them to lend to people who are, I hesitate to use the term worthy because that's really economic, that's like really morally loaded, but like, you know, who are in a position to pay it back, I guess.
I think it's one of those, I honestly think we could talk for the whole show about this one. And I think that's because it hits on such important like societal and economic challenges really, but That's what I think the report is so important for us, because it spotlights those, right? And but in a positive light, right? It's like, this is the untapped potential that we could unlock by solving for these problems using open finance. So I love it. And thank you so much for coming on to talk to us about the report. I am just going to take us through to a very quick pause here, and we will be back with you very shortly. Welcome back. Before we get back into the second half of the news, a note to go, check out our most recent FinTech Insider Insight show. Our wonderful host, Laura Watkins, is joined by 11FS product lead Nadine Timmer-Bodenstein and Laura Pomfret, co-founder of Financiel, to discuss how wealth management is, or isn't, serving women. They discuss the gaps in the current wealth offerings, how and why women's needs are not being properly met, and what the industry is, can, and should be doing to change that. It's a great discussion to celebrate Women's History Month in the UK and shines a light on a super important topic. So go check that out in our podcast feed. It's the one just below this. Now, let's get back into the news. Our next story comes from FinTech Finance News with a headline, Tide launches in Germany. Tide is a UK-based financial app for small and medium businesses, providing everything from current accounts and debit cards to full accounting services. Their move into Germany signals a new strategy to enter more markets following their launch in India in 2022. Potential members in Germany can now join the waiting list in anticipation of their full launch within the next few months. Germany is the largest economy in Europe, with over 3 million businesses, most of which employ less than 10 people. Now, we heard this from Tide's CEO, Oliver Prill.
Very excited to talk about Tide's entry of the German market. Just to put this into context, Tide is now the largest UK business financial platform. So we're serving over 10% of all UK SMEs, focusing relentlessly on those small businesses that don't have a finance function to save them time and money in their financial admin. So that has been hugely successful. Our internationalization journey started last year with the entry of India, where we already have 200,000 SME customers, and we are hugely excited by the growth opportunities in India, both because it's the largest international market for SMEs, but also the huge digitization trends. At the same time, as we look to expand our TAM, continental Europe is around the corner. And within continental Europe, you know, Germany is the largest economy. So for us, this is a huge opportunity to gain a foothold in the largest EU market, where members, SMEs, face pretty much the same challenges as in the UK. And so we look forward to making, you know, an impact in that market. Maybe final point on the German market. Often when we look at a new market, there's the question, is it actually good to be the first mover, or what happens to the existing players in the market? And what we learned in the UK, really, that there is something that we call internally the joint mover advantage, which is really when a group of new normal players get together to really change the market dynamics. And we believe that continental Europe in many ways is in that mode today. And so we look forward to working in the German market to make a difference to German SMEs.
Yeah, I mean, that's a cool insight into, I suppose, what's driving this and how excited they are about the opportunity. And I know we touched a lot on the previous story about SMEs being among sort of the most underserved segments. But Raquel, it feels like Tide really are gaining traction within that segment, having some success, and this does feel like an exciting time for them.
Yes, 100%. So we are very, very excited to be able to help Tide unlock this next stage of growth. So we are part of this sort of expansion to Europe, which is great. We've been working with them for quite some time. I think we started working together in 2018, and you know, our collaboration has changed over time as they grew. But it's nice to see that we're able to support them in this big change. What I will say is that I personally, I've lived in Germany for many years, and I spent probably half of my career marketing to German businesses. And so it's an interesting spin to the story from my personal opinion, because basically we all know, right, Germany is a big economy and it does have, you know, a very strong group of SMEs there, and they're certainly underserved. So basically the opportunity is huge for Tide, and I think they have all what it takes to succeed. I find it interesting, though, that Germany is a tricky market. Even though it is huge, it's not far, and people are savvy when it comes to new technology. But there is a barrier there. Culturally, geographically, it's very spread out, especially when you think about the SMEs, especially if you're trying to go after the so-called Mittelstand, which is more like the mid-sized business where the real meat is at. They're very spread out. They're not in the big metropolitan cities. They're very conservative when it comes to financial products. They tend to work with their local banks. So it's tricky. So you need to be very strategic how you approach this. Potentially, there is a huge opportunity for them to start with a small demographic of digital nomads, small entrepreneurs in the big cities, and then sort of trying and spread out of there. I think it makes sense, in my opinion, if you're trying to expand to Europe. If you can make it in Germany, you could probably make it everywhere. Maybe France might be slightly different because they're also very peculiar, but I think Germany makes sense in my opinion.
And I think you're right to call that out, right? I mean, the size of the prize obviously is huge, as we said, like the largest economy in Europe, but there are lots of pitfalls, right, when it comes to entering into new markets. I think you're so right when you say that sort of approach to go to market is going to be so key, right? Where do they start? How do they look to expand out? I always remember someone saying on this show some time ago that the difficulty with solving or addressing the needs of small and medium-sized businesses is for every SME, there's a unique problem. And they are a very diverse group, right? And look, you know, we've seen fintechs try and move the other way, right? We saw N26, you know, really try and establish themselves in the UK. And of course, that didn't go so well. But if they get this right, and if we go back to what we were talking about in the previous story, you know, there's huge potential here to really gain traction if they can actually address the fundamental needs of German SMEs.
Absolutely. And it's quite funny. I was at a dinner with Oliver just a few weeks ago. I asked her this question. Germany is a phenomenal opportunity and Tide are a brilliant business, right? And Oliver's a fantastic CEO. I think I hadn't spent a huge amount of time in Germany, but I did live in Switzerland for 5 years. And I know a number of small businesses that operate in Germany. And I'd say one of the challenges with Germany is they're not the fastest of early adopters. Which could be a challenge. And, you know, things can be quite conservative over there for a number of different reasons, which Raquel has really pointed out really quite elegantly. I mean, I think fantastic opportunity if they can make it. It's an interesting first choice of destination. Great to see a British fintech that's actually looking to expand into Europe and not the other way around. Interesting that they've chosen mainland Europe and not America, which is often where we see a lot of fintechs try to expand to first. Obviously, they already dipped their toes into international waters in India, which is an unusual choice for a UK fintech. But they've been fantastically successful, and India is not an easy place to launch business, right? So I think there's definitely, they've got the muscle memory when it comes to launching a business abroad, which is great. I think it's often quite difficult for UK businesses to get the capital they need to be able to expand internationally. And I'm sure David can talk about those international pains, obviously having come into the UK market. But look, if he can get it right, I'll be really excited to see what he can achieve.
Yeah, I completely agree. And you've teed me up quite nicely to go over to David. What's your sort of experience and your sort of reflections on this one, David?
I'm still very much a student, I suppose. So, you know, we are a UK-based bank, but we do have global aspirations. We are trying to think about European expansion. And it is it's a tough market to crack, right? And I think Germany in particular can be, I wouldn't say it's the most difficult market, right? But it has some unique challenges that come with it. I think it'll be really interesting to see how Tide fares against Konto, who obviously will have picked up Penta's book of business. But look, I mean, you know, more choice for SMEs is a good thing, right? I think especially when you kind of compare the new offerings in terms of kind of quality of product experience against what you can get with one of the incumbents. I mean, it's just kind of night and day. I wish them the best.
Yeah, no, exactly. Like ditto. I think it's exciting, yeah, to see such a UK success story looking to expand out into other markets. So can only wish them the best. All right, I'm going to move us on to our next story. So global local payments platform PPRO raises €85 million from investors, including JPM and PayPal. So PPRO's latest funding comes after it achieved record revenue in 2023. And now it's looking to capitalize on its success to achieve further growth. Quote, our focus on helping customers access new markets by creating seamless local payment experiences is validated by the strong demand we're seeing. The firm will use the fresh capital to pursue growth in key markets and further enhance its global network of local payment methods. So to find out more, we heard from Mossy Bring, CEO of PPRO.
Hi, this is Mati Bring. I'm the CEO of PPRO. For those not familiar with us, we specialize in local payment methods in Europe and Latin America. Our mission is to simplify access to market, and we work with PSPs and merchants alike as they enter the many fragmented markets across the globe. We're super excited to share the news about our new round of fundings. We see it as a huge vote of confidence from our investors as we double down our efforts to grow with our customers, our prospects and partners, and really solidify our position in the market. There's a huge opportunity for us now to grab an even bigger market share, ensure that we increase the number of payment methods that we have available and increase the number of customers that we're able to provide their services to. So we're very excited about the prospect of what's coming up for us and our ability to service our customers even better in the years to come.
Nice. Look, lots of like good news stories, right? And sort of like people raising and expanding into new markets and all that sort of stuff, right? Maybe like the rumors of the death of fintech have been very much over exaggerated. But as much as look, some of the other topics that we've touched on in terms of maybe where fintech and financial services are underperforming, I think one of those areas still, although there's lots of sort of movement in this space, is around cross-border payments. So I think seeing something again that's sort of really targeted towards tackling that problem is encouraging. What was, Raquel, what was your sort of initial reaction to this one?
So in my opinion with regards to localized payment methods, I think that's super key when it comes to inclusion, right? Because if you are a global company trying to expand globally, it's important that the payment experience is part of the product experience. And every country has a preferred way of paying, I would say. And there is this sort of default assumption that people are fine with, let's say, pulling out their credit card or whatnot. So for example, previously, before joining Edenred, I worked at, for example, Go Cardless, and their main product at the time, obviously they expanded since, but it was the direct debit payment, which is a very popular way of paying, for example, in many countries, including Germany. So it's one of those things where it's very hard to just do it on your own. And it's important to partner with someone that can help you do that a lot easier. Having said that, it is tricky because you are also fighting against the bigger ones, like, for example, the credit cards that are very, very strong at trying to get more people to use credit card and use credit card for payments and have all these incentives from a, for example, in the US, right? It's extremely hard to fight the credit cards there. As I said, I think it's important to have it as part of your product experience and thinking about payments and being inclusive of thinking, okay, these countries, they prefer to pay this way. But at the same time, it can be challenging as well, fighting the big guys.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think what's interesting though is the appetite and like the sort of market demand being there. I think is sort of borne out by like some of the people that they're working with, right? They've provided cross-border payment tools to the likes of PayPal and Stripe and Citi, right? Like really, really big brands. They've also got some big brand backers, as we said, right? So JPM, again, Citi, PayPal. So yeah, the belief is there. It feels like the appetite is there from the market. They reach unicorn status after a $180 million investment in 2021. So we talk about success stories. I mean, as this feels like a big one, right?
Yeah, I mean, to me, this is just phenomenal. And I think it's great to show that exactly as you said, fintech is still very much alive and kicking and, you know, continues to be a massive growth opportunity. It's also great to see the big banks continuing to partner with fintechs. And I think that's part of the story that's really important. You know, my first foray into fintech was back in 2014 when I launched my co-founded fintech Neighbor. And back then, it was all about the fintechs, the challenges taking on the banks, right? Whereas now, you're starting to see very much this partnership mentality approach to things as we go forwards. And it doesn't surprise me to see JP so involved in this. I think they backed the New York Techstars cohort to the tune of some like $80 million. So, you know, and partnership innovation is really part of their core DNA. So brilliant to see. Great to see the continued rollout of this, of PPM. So I just think it's fantastic news.
Yeah. Likewise. David, is this cross-border payments and then that sort of underlying payment infrastructure that supports it? Is this, do you see a huge opportunity here?
Oh my God. Yeah. Like absolutely massive. I do think also, I mean, to your point, like kind of earlier about like, this is a good news. This is the fintech good news hour. Like, I think that we are starting to come out of the dark period. Like, I think
but say it quietly,
the FT right? had an article. Yeah, yeah. Well, but the FT had an article like whatever, like this week, I think, that basically was like, all right, it seems that we're back to like risk on, right? Like in the public markets, right? And that then like flows down to everything that happens in private markets. So I'm on the one hand, I hope that we don't go back to a time in which scooter companies can hoover up hundreds of millions, if not billions, and then go bust like 2 years later.
Yeah.
At the same time, I also would like for it to be a little bit easier for startups to get the growth capital that they need. And I think this is, there's like more and more signs of green shoots, I think, which is really cool.
I agree with you. I think what's really nice about how you said that as well is that you're really sort of reinforcing what you said earlier about at your core, just being a sort of like a compliance nerd. And like, I want to see growth, but I want to see responsible growth.
Look, that has nothing to do with compliance and everything to do with my like Schadenfreude, right? Of like watching these other companies like suck up capital that could have gone to deserving businesses. And I mean, it's a narrative that has a happy ending for me, which is that the investors lost money on those deals. But like, I wish that they had just given the money to us and to other people at this table. And then we could have built like more deserving things. So
you would like to think that the net result of what we've been through the last few months in the fintech industry with capital drying up and all of that sort of stuff. And now, as you say, those green shoots of recovery, you would like to think that there has been a shift in the right direction from that respect.
Let me put it this way. I want there to be capital available and I want the investors to exhibit a degree of capital discipline. That's all. That's all I'm asking for.
Superb. I love it. Okay, now for a quick look at some more click-worthy news this week. So this one comes from CNBC with a headline, Stripe reveals it passed $1 trillion in total payment volume in 2023. So Stripe's annual letter announced they have surpassed $1 trillion in total payment volume in 2023. which is up 25% from 2022. They hit this 15 years after the company was founded. By comparison, PayPal surpassed $1 trillion in total payment volume in 2021, 23 years after it was founded. The Collison brothers attributed the growth to Stripe's enterprise business, fast-growing startups, adopting its products, and billing and tax services. Well, look, all we needed for like the FinTech Good News Hour was like chuck a Stripe story in there. Nothing that these guys do will probably ever surprise me again. This just like speaks to the strength of their proposition. The scale is absolutely incredible. And yeah, look, I mean, congratulations to them. And now it's time for the and finally section of the show, a look at something more lighthearted from the week's news. And in this week's case, with a headline, UK restaurants could start to adopt, quote, surge pricing after success in the US. Now, if you're not familiar with the term, surge pricing is when retailers increase their prices during certain periods. Taxi companies and travel agents have been doing this for many years, but now it seems restaurants may be cashing in on this too. It is becoming increasingly popular among US restaurants and may creep over into the UK too. Popular high-end pub chain Slug and Lettuce, popular, has been trialing this since September last year in what has since been dubbed, quote, unhappy hour. I don't even know where to go with this one. Raquel, like, would you pay more to eat at peak times?
Absolutely not. It's wild. Yeah. I was reading about this and thinking to myself, oh, wow, okay, where do we get to? You know, is cost of living crisis even a term to some of these people? So, no, it's bizarre, in my opinion. The only way I could see it maybe work is, let's say, for example, if you do have a service fee that maybe you increase it slightly because, I don't know, you maybe need more staff or they're much more stretched, but not increase the overall price for the food, I think. My opinion. I could be wrong.
I think that's a nicer take on this, right? Like, the staff will run off their feet because it's super busy, so fair enough, let's surge price the tip or whatever that looks like. That's a much better way of doing it. But it doesn't surprise me that it's like Slug and Lettuce that are sort of like pioneering this very dystopian future. But like, I just feel like off the back of the cost of living crisis.
You were expecting like Spoons or,
you know. I mean, maybe, yeah. I don't know. I feel like Spoons is like the reverse of surge pricing, whatever that is. But I feel like just off the back of like, the cost of living crisis that came off the back of the pandemic and sort of shrinkflation and things costing more and like paying more for less and all that sort of stuff. Like, Ez, like, who would go in for this?
I find the term success really interesting for a product that fundamentally upsets your customers. All right. Just like, really? Success? I mean, I've never felt happy when I've got surge price off of Uber. So I can see the logic in it from an Uber perspective, right? The whole purpose of surge pricing, let's forget what might be happening behind the scenes, but was fundamentally to attract more drivers to a location where you have more demand, right? And because they're moving all over the place, it's like, you know, a honeypot. It brings them all to the same place, and then it ensures you can service your customers in spots that are really busy. That's not the case in a restaurant, because their staff are already there. They're already serving the people. And like Raquel said, unless you're going to pay them more or the food costs more, why are you charging customers more? You already have booking systems that deal with that surge of customers. So it just feels like a price gouging exercise to me. So I'm definitely against it. Now, I'm a big fan of market forces, but this does not seem like the right time to introduce a solution like this.
I think that's exactly right. Like, David, do you think Ez is right? Like, is the customer just forgotten and lost in all of this?
I mean, it just feels unnecessary. You know what I mean? Like, I'm trying to imagine, like, going back, like, you know, to 20, 30 years, like, what would happen if you told someone in like the 90s that the lunch rush was going to be subject to surge pricing? Like, they would just look at you like you were like a crazy person.
Yeah.
Dystopian.
Try to explain it by giving them the Uber comparison, and they'd be like, I don't know.
Like, I think in America, like, there's already there's already a built-in like soft surge pricing in the form that you feel so bad for your server that you tip them more. Like you're not made to do it, but you do it. I would feel very, I'd be like, oh, sorry. So because you're really busy, you want me to pay more for what is highly likely to be a worse experience.
Exactly. All right. Well, look, thank you to Slug and Lettuce for ruining FinTech Good News Hour. I mean, I'd take against them just for that, if nothing else. But that does wrap up this week's FinTech Insider News. Thank you so much to today's guests. Let's just go quickly around the virtual room. Maybe you can tell us a little bit where people can find out more about you and your companies. Raquel, let's start with you.
Well, you can find me on LinkedIn, or if you want to learn more about EdenRed Payment Solutions, visit our website, eps.edenred.com.
Excellent. Thanks, Raquel. How about you, David?
My inbox is already a very, very frightening place to live. So rather than refer you to me, I'm going to just refer you to our website, which is griffin.com, where you can learn about all things Griffin.
Love it. And Ez, how about you?
Well, you can always find me on LinkedIn, but similar to David, my inbox is a horror show. But the best place to find out more about CFIT is definitely on our website, cfit.org.uk, where you can find out all about the last coalition we just worked on. You can find the blueprints, and you can also get access to all the technical resources that we created off the back of it.
Excellent. And Ez, maybe you should come back and we should do a deep dive show just on the report.
Absolutely.
Because I think we
That'd
can
be brilliant.
It. All right, then. And as for me, you can still, for some reason, find me on X, formerly Twitter, at Ross Gallagher 07. I might be able to move up the 07s. I could maybe get 06 now, the way people are leaving. And thank you for listening. Do join the conversation on social media or email podcast@11fs.com. Thanks very much and goodbye.